genetically modified food, would you eat it? Is it the way of the future? What is it, in fact? Now, Professor Ian Godwin is the University of Queensland's Director of Crop Science. He's written a new book, Good Enough to Eat, about new genetic plant and animal breeding technologies, and joins me on the line. Professor, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. How are you going, Mark?
I'm well, thank you. What is genetically modified food?
Oh, the simplest explanation I can give you is all of our food's been genetically modified by plant breeders and humans just selecting new types of flowers, fruits, vegetables since forever. The thing that people talk about when they talk about genetically modified food, it means that something has been taken out of a plant, in other words, a piece of DNA, manipulated in a laboratory and then put back in to a plant or animal. So with genetically modified food, you can take a piece of DNA from anywhere and put it into your favourite tomato or potato or whatever.
So simple, and I understand when you talk about genetically modifying, you know, cattle, etc., to make them better, etc. People, I think, understand that. And some simple examples, say from vegetables, are say purple carrots and different coloured broccoli and all that sort of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, so they're all naturally occurring mutants that people have done breeding with.
Yep.
We can do the same thing with genetic modification as well. I can give you a great example, though. In potatoes, all potatoes are susceptible to a fungus called late blight. That's what caused the potato famine in Ireland in the 1860s. There's no potatoes that we know of that have got resistance. With genetic modification, we can take resistance genes from wild relative potatoes, inedible potatoes, and put one or two of those genes into a potato, and then the potato is resistant to late blight. And that actually cost billions of dollars in fungicides all over the world. And when I say fungicides, I mean it doesn't matter whether they're organic potatoes or otherwise, there have been chemicals applied to control that disease. And if we can do it genetically, you can actually get a fungicide-free potato, for example.
So when we talk about genetically modified food and looking into the future, we're talking about, are we not, having our food sustainable, as cheap as possible, to try and feed as many people as possible in a healthy way.
That's right. And I can give you some nice examples where it even goes beyond that. It's not just about having cheap food readily available and the most sustainable as well. We can do all that, but we can even do things. So, for example, with animals, everyone has heard of things like bird flu and swine flu. It's now possible, and it's been demonstrated in the lab, that using new techniques of gene editing, we can actually make poultry, and that doesn't matter whether they're chickens or ducks or whatever, resistant to all known bird flu. Now, doing that means not only is that a production thing, because you're not going to have chickens keeling over when they've got bird flu, but if they can't get bird flu, they can't then pass it on to humans. So we can actually not only make that industry more sustainable, we can actually make it safer for everyone.
So what you're talking about is different, is it not, to, say, animals that are already alive being given injections or pills or tablets to make them grow quicker or make them, you know, taste better?
That's right. And with the new gene editing technologies, you can simply change one or two little base pairs inside a gene and give these give animals resistance. Another example I think I already talked about was swine flu. So it was noticed that there are some particular wild pigs that never get swine flu, and a bunch of scientists worked out that there's a very minor difference of one gene between those wild pigs and domesticated pigs. They changed the gene in the domesticated pigs so that it was the same as the wild version of the gene, and the pigs are resistant to swine flu.
So what are the dangers here, though, Ian? Because we, you know, Newton's laws of physics, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, and we're talking about yesterday on this program that insects are in danger and might be disappeared in a century or two, and everything seems to have its reason to be on the planet in a natural system. Is there a danger that that balance could be upset?
Well, if you do it incorrectly, definitely that danger could be upset. There was, for example, a bit of a scare in the 1990s when some insect-resistant corn was deemed to produce toxins that would kill things like monarch butterflies. It turns out, in fact, after a lot of research subsequent to that, that that wasn't the case, and that the BT gene, as it's known, we have it in Australia in cotton, similar genes used in corn or maize in the US, didn't have any effect on the actual butterflies themselves. However, you've got to bring into mind, from a sustainability point of view, if we don't have an insect-resistant crop, what are we doing to protect against the insect? Well, we're spraying. Mm. So pesticides at the moment are a major cause of affecting insects. And a big part of that is because they're not particularly selective. You might be spraying your crop for aphids, but it's also affecting bees and ladybirds, etc.
And the wind will take it elsewhere. The runoff into rivers and streams that
affect it. Exactly, yeah. Exactly, and into the nearby swimming pool or whatever.
Mm.
So if you've got that that focused toxicity to one particular caterpillar, so for example, in cotton in Australia, it's Heliothus, what happens there is then you actually see an increase in all the number of other insects that are around, because prior to BT cotton, the sprays that were used on cotton to get rid of Heliothus were also getting rid of pretty much every other insect.
So one of the biggest things, in just summing up, Ian, that to get people to accept and understand is, going back to what we discussed before, is to get rid of the stigma that genetically modified does not mean animals or plants that are already growing being injected with stuff. It is about having modifications done so that they are resistant to, a little bit like we have with vaccinations, etc., resistant to diseases.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And you could go further and say that one of the reasons why there's been a sort of a demonization of GMOs is because the organic food movement, when it was in its infancy, decided they needed some things to say this is not organic, and GM crops and animals was one of the things they said, this is not organic. And then they went on a big program to effectively say GM is bad and organic is good. And they created this dichotomy that still, to a lot of people's mind, it's you know yourself, it's easy for people to see things as black or white, when in fact there's a heck of a lot of grey in there.
Good on you. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, great to talk to you.
Professor
Thank you.
Ian Godwin, who is the Director of Crop Science at the University of Queensland, he's written a new book, Good Enough to Eat. It's about new genetic plant and animal breeding technologies. Interesting. The fact that we do have this stigma, I think we all, not all of us, maybe it is just me, that when you think about genetically modified everything, it's all mutants and all these sorts of things, and it's bad for you. But what they're trying to do is make things a lot more resistant. Genetically modified crops use 37% less pesticide, increase crop yields by nearly a quarter, and increase the profits for farmers who are doing it tough by nearly 70%. Good Enough to Eat is the name of the book by Professor Ian Goodwin. It's 16 to 4.